Okay, folks, there are quite a few of quiz threes left upstairs, so if you haven't picked up your quiz, I've left it outside again, so do pick it up when you get a chance. Yesterday's email, I mean last night's email, I didn't mean to scare you, but there's only 2 weeks left in the class, so I just wanted to let you know what was coming, because I know you'll have other stuff coming up too, so just to get your timetable cleared out. Okay, so the project is due 2 weeks from today. Right? No. Is it? Yeah, 2 weeks from today. Okay. Time sure flies. So 2 weeks from today, it's due at 5 p.m. that day. Okay. There are two final exams. One is the early final, December 16th from 10 to 12 in KMAC 260. The other is 1 to 3 on Friday here. You know, I'll put up a Google shared spreadsheet so I'll make sure you can't tamper with stuff, like to move other people from one exam to the other. So at least I have a sense of who's coming to which exam. Okay. And that's about all the groundwork. We're pretty much done with everything else. Three quizzes behind us, mystery project is done, so we're almost there. Right? So let's pick up where we left off. We were talking about option pricing. I know it was in a... So what we're going to start off today with is to kind of look at the essence of what this optionality is. Okay? So I'm going to give you a very simple example to illustrate the power of real options and how they can sometimes get you into trouble. So let's say you have a small startup company. Okay? It's come up with this new technology that allows people to download stuff quickly without requiring huge amounts of broadband. The cost of implementing the technology is $2 billion. So it's a costly technology. And based on the expected revenues today, the present value of the cash flows is $1.5 billion. So if this were a capital budgeting project, whatever I just told you about this project, net present value is minus $500 million, right? It's a non-viable technology. At least today, it's not. But you have the rights to it for an extended period, 10, 15, 20 years. Now, let's assume you work for an established cell phone company, Samsung, somebody manufactures phones, and or you can make it Verizon or T-Mobile if you want to expand the business. This is a non-viable technology. And in capital budgeting, in corporate finance, we're told, if you have a non-viable technology, net present value is zero or negative, you shouldn't pay for the technology. But let's break that mold. Can you visualize a scenario where you might be willing to pay for a non-viable technology? And if so, I'm going to kind of push you on it. Might you pay for this non-viable technology? Nobody here would? And if so, why? What are you paying for?
If there's potential for the cost to implement to decline in the future or the expected cash flows to increase, you may want to buy it so that your competitor then will not buy it in the future.
Okay, the last part I would not have added, because now you're wandering into dangerous ground, right? You're saying, I'm going to do it because even if it's a bad project, I don't want somebody else to have first rights to a bad project. Let's stop at the first step. The cost might change, the cash flows might change. This is always true for any project, right? So why on a conventional project can we never use that excuse of, hey, the net? What is it about this project that allows you to use that argument to pay something for it? What do you have? Exclusive rights to the technology. In other words, you can never use this argument if you have a technology, we don't have exclusive rights. Because if the numbers change, somebody else can jump in as well. It's a fact that things can change and I give you exclusive rights that gives you value. So it has nothing to do with anybody else. It's a fact that you're buying an option. Do you see what the option is? Right now it's an out-of-the-money option. The strike price is $2 billion. The stock price, or the equivalent of it, is $1.5 billion. But you have 15 years that you can wait and hope that something changes. In this case, that S will get greater than K. So hold on to that thought, because now I'm going to push you on that thought. Okay? So let's assume you're willing to think about paying for this technology. It's not viable. My question is about how much you're willing to pay and what it will depend on. If I increase the number of years that you can have this exclusivity, what should happen to the value of the right? Go up or go down? It should go up. So if I give you the right for 1 year, it's worth a lot less than 15 years. In fact, let me push you on that as well. If I gave you the right in a country where legal rights are fully enforced, you'd pay more than in a country where legal rights are a little fuzzy, right? Let me ask you the second question. This is where you're going to see why people get uncomfortable with options. So you have a non-viable technology. As I increase the uncertainty about future in this technology, you have no idea how broadband will evolve, how smartphones are going to change. Will that increase the value of this right or decrease the value of this right? You think it's going to decrease the value of this right? Increase the value of this right? So they sound so much alike, you can probably get away with just saying either. That sounds strange, right? A risk is supposed to be a bad thing. Why is increasing the risk actually making your right more valuable? In fact, give me an intuitive. Tell me what will happen if you were certain about this market. What's going to happen to the value of this option? If you are guaranteed that the cash flows are never going to change, the value of this option is going to go to zero because you're, in a sense, guaranteed a $500 million negative net present value. You do not want certainty in a world like this. You want uncertainty. And the more uncertainty there is, the greater the chance you will dig out of the hole. And that's the one thing I want you to get out of these next two sessions is, even if you never use an option pricing, it changes the notion of risk on its head. And the more uncertainty you have about the future, the more valuable the option becomes. Which brings me to my final question. So let's say you bid for this technology. You get it. And let's say you were right. The costs come down, the value of the cash flows go up, it becomes a viable technology. You still have 14 years left on the rights. Would you develop the technology the minute it becomes viable? What's the analogous question I'm asking you with an option? You buy an out-of-the-money option. The stock price moves in your direction. The option becomes in the money. Would you exercise the option? What do you give up by exercising the option? the optionality is gone, right? You get the net present value. It's a positive net present value. But what do you give up? You give up the time premium on the option. What's it going to depend on? How much uncertainty there is and how much time you have left. So you could actually get a non-viable technology, have it become viable, and you might sit on it. Not forever, because clearly there's a cost to sitting on it, until it's a much better time for you to exercise. This is going to be almost life and death on some of the questions we're going to talk about today. In fact, one of the things we're going to talk about is how a patent for a drug is like an option. So you're a pharmaceutical company. You develop a patent to treat, take any disease. Make it a serious disease, a disease for which you want to cure. The drug becomes a viable drug. The present value of the cash flows exceed the cost of developing the drug. You might actually choose not to develop the drug right away as a commercial decision, but you can see the consequences will be that people with that disease might not get the drug. There is an optionality here, and that's going to lead to some very disquieting judgments you've got to make, decisions you've got to make as a company as to what you need to do once something becomes viable. So today we're going to talk about these and more options. So let's turn back to the notes. I think we were on page 19, and I was just introducing dividends into the Black-Scholes world. Remember the original Black-Scholes model? There were no dividends. It was based on the stock price, the strike price, the risk-free rate, the time to expiration, and the standard deviation, which is a problem because we know in the real world there are dividends. Here's a simple way in which you can bring dividends into the process. You have to make an assumption. If you assume that the dividend yield on the underlying asset remains unchanged over the life of the option, that's a big assumption. If you say it's going to be 2%, here's what's going to happen. Remember that underlying, the replicating portfolio to create for the call? To create the replicating portfolio for the call, what did you have to do? You had to borrow money, K minus RT times ND2, and buy ND1 shares of stock, right? Now, you had to pay interest on the borrowing, which in the old model was the only cost you had. It's basically interest. But now on the shares you own, you're now going to get a dividend. Have you seen carrying costs and futures and forwards? Basically, the carrying cost is the net of what you have to pay out versus what you get in. What you see in the model now is a netting out of the dividend yield against the riskless rate, saying if it costs you 6% to borrow money, but you get a 2% dividend yield, the net cost to you is only 4%. So the first thing you see as a difference is you get R minus Y. The second difference is, in the original model, and I'll show you the original model, you just took S times ND1. Now I take S times E minus YT. What am I doing when I do that? What did I say the exponential was? It was a present value factor, right? So when you have a 2% dividend yield every year for the next 10 years, what am I assuming is going to happen? Each time you pay a dividend, your stock price is going to drop by roughly the dividend yield, 2% a year for the next 10 years. So what I'm doing is adjusting the stock price for the expected price drops that are going to happen when the dividends get paid. If you make those two adjustments, you now have a dividend yield adjusted version of the Black-Scholes. And this is the model you're going to see me use in the real options examples we're going to talk about for the most part, because on most real options, there is the equivalent of a dividend yield that you got to factor into the model. This is the model that's going to allow you to do that. Incidentally, for those of you who don't remember your options, the way you value a put is using what's called put-call parity. In other words, you take the existing call option model, you can value a put basically on the assumption that puts and calls are connected at the hip if they have the same strike price. One final point. Options are intimidating for a lot of people. So if you want to, you can use options to intimidate people. So my preference is not to bring options out unless I absolutely have to. Okay? Because there is a simpler way in which you can bring in this optionality without ever you talking about Black-Scholes or binomial. And that is in terms of the option pricing model that you use. In fact, if you look at most real options books, they argue that you should never use the Black-Scholes to value a real option. And here's the rationale, and it's actually a very good one. What kind of options is the Black-Scholes designed to value? Talked about two kinds of options, American or European? European. And what's true about European options? They never get exercised till the expiration date, right? Now, if we're talking about a real option, you're almost always going to have early exercise. And let me give you a couple of examples. If you think of the patent on a drug as an option, and you have 17 years left on the patent, your definition of a successful drug is you want to develop the patent before the 17 years and start making money on it, not wait till the very last day of the 17th year. So almost by definition, real options get exercised early. The argument purists use is you cannot use the Black-Scholes model because it's a European option pricing model. The binomial model allows you to deal with early exercise, so you should use only binomial models to value real options. Technically, I agree with them. But practically, I don't see a problem using the Black-Scholes model to value real options. And here's why. We're already dealing with a lot of fuzziness with these option pricing models. We're taking models that were designed to value 2-month and 3-month options and valuing 15-year options. We're taking models that were designed to value options on traded assets like stocks and using them to value non-traded assets like drugs. We're already off the reservation here. To become a purist at this stage, and I'll use only binomial models, puts you in a box. So I'll say use a Black-Scholes model, accept the fact that the number you're getting is an approximation, and move on. In fact, there's an even simpler way to bring in this optionality. If you've seen decision trees in operations and statistics, decision trees, you basically put probabilities on things happening and take an expected value. If you draw a conventional decision tree, let's say biotech company, you can draw a decision tree where at each stage in the approval process, they're approved, not approved, and you draw the entire decision tree. In a conventional decision tree, what you do is you take your cash flows and you discount them all back at a cost of capital to come up with the value today. If you do that, you won't get the same value as an option pricing model. But if you do adjust your discount rate for where you are in the tree, and what I mean by that is let's say you're at stage 5 of the tree and your cash flows are guaranteed. Beyond that point, you might use the risk-free rate then. If you adjust the discount rate over time on a decision tree, you will actually get exactly the same answer using a decision tree with a risk-adjusted discount rate as you would with an option pricing model. So if you don't want to use option pricing, that's the other alternative, is to work with a conventional decision tree. So here's the bottom line. Okay. If this is a more conventional decision tree to value a company, a biotech company, which is at very early stage in coming up with a diabetes drug. So they're testing the drug can either succeed or fail. If it fails, the game's of course over and what you've lost is what you've already spent. If it succeeds, then you do further tests to see whether it's good for just type 1 diabetes, type 2, or types 1 and 2, or it fails again. And at each stage, what I'm doing is I'm drawing the probabilities of success and failure and tracing it through to what's called the end nodes. At the end nodes, I have a developed drug and I compute the present value of the cash flow. So this is the only stage where you see a discounted cash flow valuation is at the very end. If I gave you this decision tree and asked you to value this company, all you'd have to do is do what's called rolling back the tree. It sounds fancy, but you take an expected value at each stage. Yesterday, I got an email from somebody who was in this class last year who's working at Pfizer, and she's been given this assignment to draw a decision tree for a new drug they're developing. And you know where she's stuck? What's the most difficult part of this tree? It's coming up with the probabilities. Everything else is kind of simple, right? So she's saying, how do I know how to come up with the probabilities? And what's the answer to that? If you were given this assignment of drawing a decision tree for a drug, what would you draw on to estimate those probabilities? Comparables are tough, right? They're all stuck in this point. But extend that. Comparables in terms of? Other drugs have made it through the pipeline, right? So this is actually public information. You go to the FDA website, they'll actually list out stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, how many drugs enter, how many drugs get approved. So you'd actually have to draw on that history to come up with the probabilities. The data is there. So that's where I directed. I said, go look at the probabilities. Stage 1, there might be only 27% chance. And you can then finesse it because they have it by subgroups depending on what kind of drugs they were, how they were developed, how much money was spent developing them. And the bigger companies have a higher probability because they tend not to put these drugs into the FDA approval process unless they feel more assured. But if you can get those probabilities, you can do an expected value for a drug with multiple stages of approval required for it to become a commercial drug. So don't bring out options unless you absolutely have to. But if you do bring out options, remember the three questions. Is there an option embedded in a decision? Take it through the process. Is there an underlying asset? Is there a contingent payoff? Is there exclusivity? If there is exclusivity, then you have complete option value. If you don't have exclusivity, do not use the options argument. If you're somewhere in the middle, partial exclusivity, then you might allow for only a portion of the option value. And the third, can you use an option pricing model to value the option? It depends on whether the underlying asset is traded. The closer you get to these requirements, the better off you are. Is the underlying asset traded? Is the option traded? If they're both traded, then you're home free. If only one of the two is traded, you're in trouble. If neither isn't traded, you're in real trouble. And those are the three tests we're going to apply with every real option to see if, in fact, we're on safe ground. Okay. So let's start with options in investing. When you do a typical capital budgeting project, you take the expected cash flows, you have a risk-adjusted discount rate, you take the net present value, come up with the net present value. The net present value is positive, it's a good project. If it's negative, it's a bad project. And then you stop the process. But here's what you're missing. If you have the exclusive right to this project, you have the right to delay the project. In other words, you don't have to make the movie this year. You can make it next year, 3 years from now. The second is, by taking a project, you sometimes get the right to do other projects. For instance, you might invest in China or India. It might be a project that you look at and say, it's a negative net present value project, but it's okay because if it works, then I'm going to be able to do these five other things. That's the option to expand. And the third is, sometimes you get into a long-term project, and very early in the project, you realize you made a mistake. In other words, it's a 30-year project. But 2 years into the project, you realize the cash flows are way below what you thought they were going to be. You're not stuck continuing with this project for the next 28 years. You might have the option to walk away. That's called the option to abandon. The option to delay, the option to expand, the option to abandon. We looked at it in very general form when we did corporate finance towards the very end of that packet one in corporate finance. Today, we're going to actually start to put some numbers on all three options. So let's start off with the option to delay. Very similar to the start of the class question today. Now, when you look at a project and you do the net present value, what you're getting an answer to is, should you take the project today? So the net present value is negative, you shouldn't take the project today. But if you have the exclusive rights to this project, even though it's a bad project today, might become a valuable project in the future. What I promise you with every option, every real option, is I draw a payoff diagram. So here's what the payoff diagram looks like on the rights to a bad project. Okay? So basically, you can take the project at any time. In what you have to invest to take the project becomes the equivalent of the strike price. Even though the project has a negative net present value right now, at some point in time in the future, the present value of the expected cash flows might exceed the strike price, in which case you end up with a positive net present value. Of course, that might never happen, in which case at the end of the project life, you just throw away the project because it never became a positive net present value project. The right to delay is actually the core of two of the most significant real options in practice. The first is when you have a patent. With a patent, think of what you get the right to do. You get the right to develop the patent into a commercial product any time over the life of the patent. Notice how I phrase that. You have the right to develop this patent into a commercial product. You don't have the obligation. So if you think about the payoff diagram, here's what it looks like. If the cost of developing the patent is I, you can call it whatever you want, and if the present value of the cash flows from developing today is V, if V is greater than I, you develop the patent, you make the difference, V minus I. V is less than I, you sit and hope that something changes and the patent becomes a viable patent. Okay? So in terms of payoff diagrams, here's what it looks like. The cost of converting the patent into a commercial product becomes a strike price. The present value of the cash flows from developing the patent becomes the equivalent of the stock price. The life of the option becomes the life of the patent. And how did he get this patent in the first place? How do most companies end up with patents? What do they do? What are the two ways you can end up with patents? One is you spend on R&D, so R&D becomes the cost of the option. The other is you buy the patent, which becomes... So that's the cost of the options. If you buy a patent or you invest in R&D to get a patent, the patent never becomes a commercial product. What you lose is what you paid to get the patent. So that's going to be the starting point for how we're going to value patents as options, is to think of it as a call option, with the strike price being the cost of converting the patent into a commercial product. So what I'm going to do with each of these options is to try to put them into the framework of option pricing models. Option pricing models, I need six inputs, right? S, K, R, T, sigma, and the dividend yield. I'm going to think about what those numbers will look like for this option. Let's start with this. What's the underlying asset in this option? The product that comes out of the patent, right? That's basically the underlying asset. It's not traded, so let's put that to the side. If you ask me to estimate the value of the underlying asset today, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do a conventional capital budgeting analysis, assuming you develop the patent today. I know you don't plan to, but I'm going to act like you develop it today. So I'm going to get the expected cash flows, get a risk-adjusted discount rate, take the present value and say, that's your present value of the cash flows. Not a net present value, because I'm not going to net out the initial investment. Just the present value of the future cash flows. That's going to become the S in the model. For the strike price, I'm essentially going to get the cost of what you'll have to invest today to make the product commercial. So the factory you're going to build, the land you have to buy, that becomes a strike price. I'm going to have a little bit of a problem in the variance in the value of the underlying asset, right? Because with a conventional traded asset, I can go look up the stock price variance in the last 2 years or 5 years. Here I have a present value of cash flows. I have only one number. There are two ways I can get a variance. One is I can cheat and look at the variance of publicly traded companies in the space, and that's what the variance of my cash flows is going to be. The other is, remember when we did simulations, you got a distribution of value? We did that with, you know, ExxonMobil. You could do that for any project and get a present value, and you could get a standard deviation or a variance from that simulation present value and use that as your variance in the project. The expiration of the option is whenever the patent expires. And now we run into a little bit of an issue. If you just put numbers into an option pricing model and you do not introduce a cost to exercising early, a cost to not exercising early, here's what's going to happen. You're going to hold on to the option to the very end of the life, because what do you lose by holding it? You just get the time premium. So I'm going to introduce a cost of delay. And here's why I need to do that. If your patent becomes viable 2 years from now and you have 15 years left on the patent, you can exercise right away and develop the patent. But if you do that, you lose the time premium, right? So that's your cost from exercising early. But if you don't exercise early, what do you lose? You have 15 years left in the patent. You've chosen not to develop the patent. You let the clock run. Over the next year, you've given up one out of the 15 years of protection you had. That's what a patent gives you. It gives you the protection from competition. So each year you wait, you're going to give up 1 year of protected cash flows. I'm going to approximate that by saying, if there's 15 years left on the patent, I choose not to exercise the option. I choose not to develop the patent, even though it's viable. I give up 1/15 of my cash flows. It's a simplification, and we'll talk about more complicated ways of doing it, but that's going to become the equivalent of the dividend yield. You ready? Let's try this on a real drug. I'm going to go back in time to 1997. When a biotech company called Biogen, it's still around, developed a drug called Avonex. At that time, they just got the patent on Avonex. It's a drug to treat MS, and they had 17 years left on the patent. You're saying, why are you going to all the way back? Why can't we use something more current? To do this, I needed access to internal information. You're going to see in a moment what I mean by internal information. So they've just got this patent on Avonex. They come to you and say, we'd like you to value Avonex for us. If I want to value it as an option, what's the first step? I act as if they develop the drug right away, right? And once they develop the drug, they're going to get revenues and operating income. So the first step is getting the present value of the cash flows from developing Avonex right away. Have you ever seen pharmaceutical companies actually estimate cash flows on a drug? It's a little morbid. What they do is they take the percentage of the population that have MS, they take the percentage of that population who come into a doctor and diagnosed as having MS, and it's not 100%. Then they take the percent of the people who are diagnosed as having MS who are given the right drug, which is not 100%. And they take the percent of the people who are given the right drug who actually take the drug, which is not 100%. So basically, they start with 100 people, and by the time they might end up with 8 people taking the drug. And then they project revenues and operating expenses and operating income based on that. That's the number I had access to with Avonex that I don't have access to with most current drugs. Is I was able to get my hands on an internal capital budgeting exercise done by Biogen, And the present value of the cash flows they got from developing the drug right away was $3,422 million. Hold on to that number because that's the present value of cash flows from developing the drug right away. Biogen had never actually fully developed a drug before. They'd actually come up with drugs and license them out. They'd never actually sold a drug. So they decided on Avonex to do this on their own. They'd have to invest in infrastructure and costs and factories. And they estimated the cost of doing that would be $2.875 billion. You pause right there. They developed the drug today. The present value of the cash flows is $3,422 million. The cost of developing the drug today is $2,875 million. If this were a capital budgeting class and asked you for the net present value, you're going to take 3,422 minus 2,875, which would be 547 million. The net present value of this drug developed today is 547 million. If somebody remember that number, because now I'm going to think of it as an option. They haven't developed the drug yet. They have 17 years left on the option. The riskless rate then was 6.7%. Remember, in option pricing, you got to use a T-bond rate that matches up to the life of your option. So there's a 17-year bond. The variance in the expected present values, I cheated. I cheated because I don't know enough about this business to do a Monte Carlo simulation. So what I did was I took the variance in stock prices of biotech companies, which are young biotech companies. Implicitly, what I'm assuming is the main reason stock prices change in these companies is because of changes in the present value of the cash flows underlying it. That's an assumption. That was 0.224. Is this a viable drug already? Yeah, if you develop it, you make 547 million. So if you choose not to develop it, what do you give up? You give up one out of the 17 years of protection that you have. So I introduce that as my equivalent of the dividend yield. I say by doing this, you're giving up the cash flows you could have got over that year. So that becomes my cost to delay. I plug it in. Now remember how we got D1 and D2 and then looked up the cumulative normal distribution? There was D1, D2, N of D1, N of D2. I'm violating that binomial option thing. But let's face it, drawing a binomial tree here is going to be a nightmare. Too many inputs to estimate. I get a value for the call option of 907 million. What is the net present value? 547. Now do you see why people like options? What have I just given you? A $360 million premium on a DCF valuation. Why? Because there is optionality. But to complete the story, Biogen, in fact, in this case, if you think about it, they should they develop the drug right away? If they develop the drug, what happens? It becomes a conventional project with a net present value of $547 million. By sitting on the drug and not developing it, bad news if you have MS, right? Because I'm saying, look, I'm going to wait a year. It's worth more as an option than it is as a developed drug. You're saying, will the drug ever be developed then? I actually, each year, think about what happens, the cost to delay. It's 117 this year, right? What happens next year? There'll be 16 years left, 116. The cost of delay is going to climb. At some point in time, you will develop. But by my estimate, if nothing changes in the present value of the cash flows, you will not develop the drug for almost 8 years from now. That's really bad news if you want drugs developed for diseases really fast. But let me close the story on a more positive note. Biogen developed the drug almost immediately. And most pharmaceutical companies in the U.S., once a drug becomes viable, will develop it. They will not wait. So what am I missing in my option pricing? Because if you believe my option pricing model, they should have waited. Why did they choose not to wait? Was it because they were being moral and ethical? Substitute drug. What does a patent give you? It gives you protection against somebody else developing the same compounds as you do to treat MS. It doesn't give you protection against a comparator developing a drug for MS. And what Biogen was seeing as it looked over its shoulder was that Merck was working on an MS drug that was 3 years away from coming to the market. In which case, what is your cost of delay? It's 1 over 3, not 1 over 17. The minute you put a 1 over 3 as your cost of delay, the option value actually drops below the net present value. So what does it tell you about what you need in the pharmaceutical market for drugs to get to the market quickly? You need lots of competition at the R&D stage. If you're a monopolistic pharmaceutical company, guess what? You will sit on drugs for a long time, especially if you already have a drug out there. You have the biggest ulcer drug out there. You've come up with this really much better ulcer drug. You're not going to jump out and hit the market right away because you're going to be cannibalizing your own drug. You're going to wait till you feel that the stars are all aligned. You're not going to wait forever, but it means that drugs are going to get to the market much more slowly. So it's not just enough that companies do R&D. You need multiple companies working on R&D on the same product. It looks like a waste of resources to have lots of companies working on it, but without that, you're going to get exactly what you saw in the option pricing model. Companies are going to wait before they develop. Question? Yeah?
Doesn't it all depend upon the uncertainty contained in the variance?
Exactly.
The less likely this option will happen.
Exactly. So in fact, let's build that further. If you think of R&D as the cost that you're paying to get these options, and as a pharmaceutical company, you're thinking about where to invest that R&D, into areas where you know a lot or areas where there's a lot of uncertainty. You can already see where my direction is going to be, right? I'm not going to be investing in, let's say the headache business is a big business, but there's a lot of certainty about the business. I'm not investing in a better headache drug. I'm going after gene therapy. That's where the so you're absolutely right. The more certainty there is, holding all else constant, the less the value of the option. There's a compensating factor, though. What was the present value, though? The S. It's expected cash flows discounted back at a risk-adjusted discount rate. So if you're in a certain environment, you might have a lower cost of capital there, which might so the holding all else constant might not always be true if you're looking across three drugs and three different businesses. But that's absolutely true. The more you know about a business, the less optionality there is. Okay. Any other questions? Now, let's suppose I wanted to value Biogen as a company. Okay. So this is just the value of one drug in the pipeline, right? But let's say my objective is to value the whole company. I'm going to do a very unconventional discounted cash flow valuation. Unconventional in what sense? If you ask me to do a traditional DCF and Biogen, I take the cash flows, I put in a growth rate, I discount the cash flows all back and say, this is the value of the company. That's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to divide Biogen into three slices. The first is, I'm going to take whatever products they've already developed that are already out there, I'm going to take the present value of the cash flows from those commercial products. That's the first slice. The second is I'm going to take any existing patents they have, which in this case is only Avonex, and I'm going to value them as options. And there's a third slice. Their R&D department is ongoing. They're going to continue to churn out more drugs in the future, right? And I'm going to estimate whatever value added there is going to be on that R&D by looking at the new patents that might come out of the R&D, net of the cost of developing it. Three slices, existing products, patents you've already developed, patents you might develop. In doing all of this, you basically have to make some judgment calls, especially in the last input, about whether R&D is value-creating, value-neutral, or value-destroying. I'm going to try my best. So let's start with the first slice there. At the time that I valued Biogen, it had two drugs already out there. Both these drugs had been licensed on fixed license fees. This is going to be critical in how you value these drugs. Fixed license fees, where they were going to get $50 million a year every year for the next 12 years, guaranteed by the licensees. So basically, they've signed an agreement. The licensees, in this case, I think it was Merck and Upjohn were the two companies that had licensed the drugs. They'd agreed to pay $50 million as a fixed fee for the next 12 years. So first step is to compute the present value of $50 million a year every year for the next 12 years, right? To do that, I need a discount rate. Now think about the risk in these cash flows. They're guaranteed by, let's say, Upjohn. So what's the risk you will not get them? If Upjohn defaults, right? So you know what I used as my discount rate for these cash flows? I used the pre-tax cost of debt of the guarantor. So it has nothing to do with cost of capital or cost of equity. It's a guaranteed amount. The only risk you will not be paid is if the guarantor defaults. So use the pre-tax cost of debt of the guarantor. The present value that I got was $397 million. Let's do a few what-ifs. What if the guarantee had been given by the U.S. government? What if Medicaid has said, look, you know what? We'll pay you $50 million a year to supply us with the drug. What did I have used as my discount rate then? I'd have used the risk-free rate. What if this had been a share of revenues license rather than a fixed license fee? Then what would I have used as my discount rate? The cost of capital. Why? Because now I'm talking about operating risk. So the way a license gets written will determine what discount rate to use on those cash flows. So if you're valuing a young biotech company that has a license out there and it's getting paid, take a look at how the license is structured, because it's going to tell you what discount rate to use on that cash flow. And this actually has implications for how we think about cash flows in general at companies. If a portion of the cash flow is guaranteed, there's nothing wrong with using a risk-free rate to discount those cash flows. Hey, part of the reason I say that is we get so caught up in cost of equity and cost of capital as discount rates, we sometimes forget that they don't make sense when you're discounting a guaranteed cash flow, guaranteed by the government, guaranteed by another entity. So the pre-tax cost of debt is my discount rate, which is 7%. The present value is $397 million. So I have $397 million as the value of my existing drugs. I have $907 million as my Avonex as an option. Then I tried to value the third slice, and this was a bit of a nightmare. And it's always a nightmare, so I'll tell you how I resolve my own nightmare. So in this case, Biogen has continuing R&D. In the most recent year, they spent about $100 million in R&D. And based on their history, it looks like they're going to grow that R&D pretty substantially, about 20% a year, each year for the next 10 years, and 5% thereafter. So I have my R&D expenses for the next 10 years and beyond. Half the equation is done, right? Now, for R&D to create value, it has to generate returns that exceed the cost of capital, right? It's like any other investment. That's why we capitalize R&D. I'm going to assume, and this is an assumption, I'll come back and talk about how I came up with the exact number, that every dollar invested in R&D creates $1.25 in value for Biogen. You know how I came up with the extra 25 cents? Is I looked at the return on capital at pharmaceutical companies and compared to the cost of capital. If the return on capital is roughly equal to the cost of capital, R&D is collectively doing what? Just running in place. If the return on capital is higher than the cost of capital, it's creating value. What I did was I took that excess return and I said, if I invest a dollar in R&D, how much would that excess return create in value? That $1.25 is the big assumption here, because it means that my R&D is going to create value for the next 10 years. I did this a long time ago, in 97. Today, when I value big pharmaceutical companies, and some of you might have read my blog post on drug companies and how they're changing, guess what I estimate is the value of future R&D when I'm valuing a Pfizer or a Merck? At best case, it's going to be zero. If they do acquisitions, it could be worse, right? The R&D itself has become almost running in place for big pharmaceutical companies. So that $1.25 is very quickly converged in a dollar, and which is part of the reason many pharmaceutical companies are looking outside at acquiring growth rather than investing in R&D. Okay? So that's $1.25. That's going to be a big factor. I'm very uncertain about this slice, so I'm going to use a much higher discount rate. I'm going to use the cost of capital of very young biotech companies which have no commercial products. And in essence, I'm saying it's a much riskier component of the cash flows. That's a 15%. So here's what the value is. I have the R&D cost first. That's what I estimated first. That multiplied by $1.25 gives me the value of the patent. There's the value created, discounted back at 15%, the present value that I get from future R&D. So think of this as value created by future R&D is $318 million. Beyond year 10, I assume that you get back to just running in place. There's no value. It's not that they stopped doing R&D, but there's no value created from R&D. So I'm ready. I add the three numbers together. Value of existing products, 397. Value of Avonex as a patent, plus value of future R&D, $1.622 billion. I add cash, subtract out debt. In this case, both were pretty close to zero. Divide by the number of shares. I get a value per share of $45.70. I can compare this to a conventional DCF. In a conventional DCF, the effect of having Avonex would have shown up as a higher growth rate in my cash flows, right? That's the only vehicle I have. This is a different way of thinking about valuation, especially for small biotech companies, is to value them in slices. Don't try this on a Merck or a Pfizer. You'll go crazy because you'll have hundreds of patents, lots of things going on, It's much easier when you have a small company with one or two patents to do this than it is for a large company with lots of patents. Any questions on the three slides? So let's pass this particular option through the three tests. Remember, is there an option? Is there exclusivity? Is there, you know, can we apply an option pricing model? Let's start with the first one. Is there an option? Yeah, I think so. The option is that you have a patent and you have a contingent payoff. You can develop the drug, and you develop the drug if and only if the value of the cash flows exceeds the cost of developing the drug. So clearly the option test is met. Is there exclusivity? We kind of answered it. You have exclusivity, but not complete exclusivity. You have exclusivity in the sense that U.S. law protects your patent from others infringing on it. But you have competition from other pharmaceutical companies developing their own patents to treat the same drug. So the greater the competition there is among pharmaceutical companies, the less value there is to the option. And third, can I use an option pricing model? Only very gingerly. And here's why. The underlying asset here is the drug that comes out of the patent. It's not traded. The option is the patent. It's not traded. I have a non-traded option on a non-traded asset. I'm really asking for trouble if I use replication and arbitrage, which is what I am in every option pricing model. So I'm kind of backtracking and say, remember the $907 million that you got from the option pricing model? Don't do anything stupid with it. This cannot be monetized the way a regular option can be. So think of it just as a way of thinking about value and let it go. But this is something to think about any time you look at a patent that somebody's acquired. Incidentally, some of the big tech companies, this has become the game that they're playing. They go by portfolios of patents from others. I think Google bought a portfolio of patents from Qualcomm. Okay? Companies, usually they're mature companies that haven't figured out what to do with these options. A Google or an Apple will pay for those options, not because they expect these options to all pay off, but they're hoping that out of the portfolio, two or three or four will become deep in the money options and pay for the rest. But when you do that, you have to think of these as options and value them as such. Any questions on patents as options? Yes?
Is this intrinsic or relative?
It is an intrinsic value. Because you're not paying, what would make it relative? Is if I took a patent and priced it based on what other people are paying for similar patents, which would be kind of tough because you'd have to say what's similar. So you might have to look at blockbuster patents, middle market patents, small market patents, and then look at what people are paying as a percentage of the potential market. So you might say, if my potential market is $1 billion, I'll pay $100 million. That would make it a pricing. This is all intrinsic value, not just because of the way I'm doing it, but because the inputs themselves are intrinsic, right? The S is a present value of the cash flows. So it's very much in the intrinsic path of valuation. It's just an extension. That's why real options are not an alternative to intrinsic valuation. They're an add-on to intrinsic valuation. Right? Yes?
If a company were to buy the patent from Biogen, mm-hmm. how much would they
end? That's a good question. That's actually why I said don't do anything rash with the $907 million, because if you're a buyer, you say, well, I should pay $907 million, you might be asking for trouble. So what should you start your bidding at? Start it at $547 million, right? I mean, and hope you get it at the discounted cash flow value. If you have to pay $700, you might go to $700, but you're not. So the $907 million is more of something that you don't want to exceed at any price. So you want to get it for well below. But think of the $547 to $907 as that range for the option value and go lower rather than higher in that range. Any other questions? So let's take a second option to delay. Let's say you're valuing an oil company, commodity company, a mining company, especially in today's market. You're going to see the relevance of what we're going to talk about. If you look at these companies, there are two sources of value. One is existing assets they've already developed from which they're getting cash flows. The other is undeveloped reserves. The essence of undeveloped reserves is you have the right to develop those reserves, not the obligation, but the right. So let's put some structure on when you'll exercise that right. Let's say the cost of developing the reserve is X. And the value of what's under there is V. If V is greater than X, you will develop the reserves and make the difference. If V is less than X, you'll sit and wait. So if I were to draw a payoff diagram for undeveloped reserves, here's what it would look like. The cost of developing the reserves becomes the equivalent of the strike price. The value of the oil, the gold, whatever is under the ground becomes the stock price. The period for which you have the rights to these reserves becomes the life of the option. And the underlying asset becomes whatever commodity will come out of the ground if you develop it. That's the undeveloped reserves. Notice, if you have developed reserves, there's no optionality. You've already decided to develop an oil reserve, nothing you can do about it. You might be able to adjust your production, but this is about decisions you make about undeveloped reserves. So again, let's think about putting some structure into this in terms of thinking about inputs you'd need for an option pricing model. So if you ask me what the S is in this model, it'll be the value of the reserves under the ground. Okay? You say, how am I going to get that? Well, this is why, you know, oil companies hire geologists. They come and tap the ground. They say 100 million barrels. You trust them. And they seem to have a better track record than equity research analysts, so I guess we could run with it. So they have reserves, you claim. You look at every oil company, right? They say, I don't know. Undeveloped reserves, a billion barrels, half a billion barrels. Here's the question you need to answer. If you develop all these reserves today, this is not a hypothetical. If you develop them today, what would you get as the present value of the cash flows? Right? So basically, first thing is you have to figure out how much oil you can get out of the ground each year. You can't get all of the oil out immediately because that's going to be technically impossible. How much oil you can get, what price you will get if you sell that oil. And my suggestion is don't bring your oil price views into the equation because then you'll mess up the whole thing. So you'd have to look at forward markets. You'd have to look at today's oil prices, what you'd get. Take the present value of those cash flows. You get the S in the model. So one input done, value the oil under the ground. The strike price is what it costs you to develop those reserves. You say, how would I know that? You're an oil company. You've done this before, I hope. So depending on the part of the world you're in, this cost can vary from close to nothing to a lot. Let me explain what I mean. If you're in Saudi Arabia, the cost of developing the oil might be nothing. Right? You stick your finger in the ground, oil comes out of the ground. No, so how much work is that? No. If you're in Canada and you're developing the reserves, the oil might be 5,000 feet under the ground and frozen for all you know. And by the time, so the cost of developing the reserves might be $50 a barrel. So depending on the part of the world that your reserves are, you have a sense of what the cost is, what it costs you to develop the reserves, that becomes a strike price. The life of the option here is how many years you have the rights to these reserves. Most oil companies, most commodity companies don't have the rights to these reserves in perpetuity. They go to an auction, they bid on the rights for the next 20, 25 years. At the end of that period, the rights revert back to the government or to the nation those reserves belong to. So that becomes the life of the option. Variance in the value of the underlying asset. What's the underlying asset here? I'm talking about a reserve of oil. It's the oil that comes out of the ground, right? So basically all I need is a variance in the oil price. This is a much easier real option to value than the option on a patent because here I can observe the underlying asset and see how it's moving. So I'm going to use the variance in oil prices, gold prices, whatever the underlying asset is. Each year that I choose not to develop this reserve, I'm giving up some cash flows, right? So once a reserve becomes viable, I want to wait to see if oil prices go up even more. But by waiting, I give up the cash flows I could have got. That becomes equivalent of my dividend yield. What I'd have got is cash flows. And finally, there's one practical issue with all these natural resource reserves. Let's say oil prices jump to $100 a barrel tomorrow. And let's say ExxonMobil decides that it wants to develop all these reserves. Some guy at ExxonMobil headquarters picks up a phone and says, develop all reserves right away. First, even assuming he says that and everybody hears it at the same time, oil doesn't start coming out of the ground right away, right? It takes about a year and a half or 2 years between the time you decide to develop reserves and oil comes out of the ground. Do you see where I'm going next? Why do you choose to develop these reserves? Because the price hit 100. What's the risk you run? By the time the oil actually starts to come out of the ground 2 years from now, oil prices might be down to $45 or $35 or $25 a barrel. That's called the development lag, the period between which you decide to develop, to exercise this option, which is develop the reserve, and oil comes out of the ground. And it's going to reduce the value of your option. So you ready? Let's try this. Again, I'm going to go back in time, and I'll explain why I can't use a current company for this example. It's actually a company called Gulf Oil. It's targeted in a hostile acquisition in the early 1980s. Okay? In early 1984, stock was trading at $70 per share. It had 165.3 million shares outstanding and debt of $9.9 billion. So file that away. Okay? The key reason it was targeted was it had reserves of about 3.038 billion barrels of oil. And based on what the geologists knew about the oil, the cost of developing these reserves would have been about $10 a barrel. So collectively, if they paid $30.38 billion, they could develop all these reserves right away. We'll see why no company would ever want to do it right away, but if they did, think of that as a strike price, the cost of developing the reserves today. The average life of these reserves was about 12 years. Some was 3, some was 5, some was 11, but the average life was 12 years. The price per barrel was $22.38, and the variable cost was $7. So each barrel of oil is going to give them $15.38 in profits. The T-bond rate was 9%. Gulf was expected to have production revenues, once it developed reserves, of about 5% of the value each year. The risk-free rate then was about, as I said, 9%. The variance in oil prices is 0.03. So oil prices are volatile. So hold on to that thought, because here's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to value the undeveloped reserves as an option. Okay? So here's what the numbers look like. Remember, when I value this as an option, the first question I ask is, if I develop all these reserves today, what would it cost me? The answer is it'll cost you 30.38. If I develop all these reserves today, and I can sell them and make $15.38 a barrel, that'll be the cash flows I get if I develop today. On the previous page, I forgot to mention, there's a two-year development lag. So if I decide to develop these reserves today, it'll take me 2 years before I actually get the cash flows. So I bring back the cash flows 2 years. It looks like I'm discounting, but what I'm effectively doing is taking out the cash flows from the first 2 years. What I get as a present value from developing the reserves today is about $42.38 billion. Again, let's play the DCF game. If this had been a discounted cash flow valuation of these reserves, the discounted cash flow value for the reserves would have been 42.38 minus 30.38, which is about 12 billion. So that's my DCF value for these undeveloped reserves. But there's an optionality. I have 12 years left to play the game. Oil prices are volatile. The riskless interest rate is 9%. And the cash flows I give up by not developing these reserves is 5%. I plug the numbers in. I get D1 and D2, N of D1 and N of D2. Somebody remind me what N of D2 measures again? What is it a probability of? It's a risk-neutral probability that S will be greater than K. What's S here? The value of the oil will be greater than the cost. There's an 85.4% chance I will develop these reserves. No surprise, because they're already in the money, but it's good to have a number to put. There's an 85% chance I will develop the reserves. The value of these undeveloped reserves, valued as an option, is $13.3 billion. What is my DCF value? It's $12 billion. I'm getting an option value of $13.3 billion. Where's the extra $1.3 billion in value coming from? The fact that oil prices are... In fact, if I made the variance in oil prices zero, you know what will happen? The value of the option will disappear. The value of the undeveloped reserves as an option will be equal to the DCF value. If I make oil prices more volatile, the premium I pay over the DCF will increase. Okay? The point I'm trying to make is, often when we think about oil companies, we think about the level of oil prices. And it's an issue, right? Oil prices go up and down. The value of oil companies go up and down. You see the additional variable I'm introducing? What kills oil companies is if oil prices drop and they get boring. Through the 1980s and 90s, that's exactly what happened. Boring in what sense? If the variance in oil prices drops and oil prices drop, then you're in big trouble as an oil company, because the premium that you have on your reserves disappears. If oil prices go up and get more volatile, you get a double premium, because you get a higher value because of the higher oil prices, and you get that premium for being volatile. So it's the volatility of oil prices that's driving the premium. And it also means that if you're comparing two oil companies, one of which gets 80% of its value from developed reserves and the other gets 80% from undeveloped reserves, they'll behave very differently as oil prices go up and down, because one is reacting not just to the level but also to the variance in oil prices. So the value of the undeveloped reserves at Gulf Oil is $13.3 billion. Again, let me complete the story here. Gulf Oil also had developed reserves on which they were getting $915 million in expected cash flows each year. There were about 12 years of oil left in the developed reserves. I discounted the 10 years of oil left. So I discount the $915 million back at the cost of capital to come up with the present value of the developed reserves. The value of Gulf Oil as a company is the value of developed reserves plus undeveloped reserves. It gets almost 70% of its value, maybe even more, from undeveloped reserves, subtract debt. I get a value of equity per share of about $51.25, lower than the $70, but now I've attached a value to the undeveloped reserves as options. You know, especially in today's markets when commodity prices are down, this is something to think about because a lot of reserves have become non-viable reserves. And non-viable in the sense, you won't even see them reported in financial statements. I think that's one of the big limitations I see in commodity companies' annual reports is they're required to report only viable reserves. So what you see as reserves listed in oil companies is only what they classify as viable. I'd actually much rather that they list out all reserves and then break it out into viable and non-viable if they want to, because I need both to be able to value an oil company with the option pricing approach. So with those of you with commodity companies, think about that optionality because it might add something to your DCF value. And the more uncertainty you have about the commodity price, the greater the upside that you're going to get from adding the option value. Any questions on real options? So let's pass this option through the test. Is there an option? Clearly. The option comes about from the fact that you get to observe the price of oil, gold, coal, whatever it is, before you decide whether to develop the reserve or not. So an easy test. Is there exclusivity? And if so, what? Where does it come from? And there's only so much oil under the ground. The exclusivity comes from the fact that there's a natural constraint, right? If oil prices go to $250 a barrel, you and I can't go digging in our backyard saying, I'm not coming back until I hit oil. We could, but then you're just going to have a big hole in your backyard and no oil. The fact that there's a natural limit means that any natural resource company, there's optionality. The only catch is, if you think of this as an energy company rather than an oil company, potentially there might be other ways of delivering energy, but you still have the optionality coming from exclusivity. In fact, I'm going to take a little tangent here and talk about real estate. Now, if you're familiar with real estate in New York, it's one of the most complicated markets to be in because everything is zoned for some amount of square footage. I still remember when I might have told the story already, but I'll say it again. But when they were putting together the architect's models for the business school, the original models that we saw had 14 floors on the building. So for 2 years, we spent all this money for a 14-floor building. About 6 months before they actually broke ground, the architect came in and said, we made a big mistake. And the mistake they'd made was they'd taken the square footage that NYU was granted for this land, but it turned out that NYU had borrowed, don't even ask me how you do this, square footage from this area and used it to build Colts. And nobody mentioned this to the architect. So he said, we have to knock off 3 floors. I remember putting up my hand and said, why don't you knock off the top 3? He said, it's not that simple. We have to redo the whole thing. It delayed us for about another 3 or 4 months while they redid the architectural details to make it an 11-story building. But to make a long story short, when you buy a building in New York, you're not just buying the building and its square footage, you're also getting the rights on that building. So let's assume you're bidding on a 3-floor building in Manhattan. But let's say that this space, you have the rights to add another 12 floors. Do you see how that's going to affect how much you pay for a building? You're going to pay not just what the building is worth, but you're also going to pay for the rights, and the rights are really options. Which means the price per square foot will vary widely across buildings depending on what optionality is in each building. So why do buildings in Manhattan have so much option value and buildings in Vegas have none? The nice thing about being an island is you're an island. Have you ever flown into Vegas? I mean, especially I've flown in probably once every 5 years for the last 30 years. Each time you fly in, the city seems to get bigger and bigger. You look out, you know, it just spreads. Same thing in Kansas. Don't go around paying premiums for buildings in Kansas City. It's just flat land. You can keep building forever. Nobody will notice. It's just long roads, right? 20 miles out. So the more the value of real estate in Manhattan or Hong Kong has an option value because you are constrained. So that's the thing to remember about. If I put a natural constraint on something, I'm creating an option value, which means that you've got to take a discounted cash flow value for a building and add a premium to reflect that option value. And finally, can I use option pricing models? The underlying asset here is, in the case of an oil reserve, I can trade on, right? The reserves themselves get traded back and forth across oil companies all the time. They sell and buy and sell these reserves. This is the closest I'm going to get to option pricing nirvana. Both the underlying asset and the option are traded. I will be able to use option pricing models with these real options much more easily than I would with patents or any other real option. Real options have their deepest roots in commodity companies and mining companies, and you can see why. They actually work really well. In fact, I know gold mining companies that have used option pricing models to decide whether to expand production, contract production. They actually use them to make operating decisions, and they're able to do it because they meet all the requirements for option pricing to actually work. Any questions on natural resource options? Yes. Well, it is that this is 85% of all the reserves. There's 100% chance that some of the reserves will get developed. So if I divide them into smaller options, so I could actually value them as, let's say I took each part of the world and I made it into individual options. I'm kind of cheating by putting them all into one big pile. Then I'm probably going to get 100% right in one and 41%. So it's like an average across all my regions, because it's not viable in every part of the world. I'm just using average prices here to kind of cover up a lot of differences across the world. So it is, in a sense, cheating. I'm taking a portfolio of options and valuing them as if they were a single option, something you can almost never get away with regular options, but I'm doing it just for convenience here, and also because the variable that drives all these options is the same one, which is oil prices. In a sense, they're highly correlated with each other, so you don't have to worry about, you know, portfolio effects. That's a good question. Or, in fact, the question is, if I decided to develop, how many barrels of oil were there? Yeah. 3.038 billion barrels of oil and pull all the oil out of the ground. The point that's being made is that's going to affect the oil price, and it's going to be, it's like a dilution effect in stock prices. So that's, in fact, another thing to factor in is, if I'm the biggest oil company on the block and I decide to develop reserves, I have a much bigger impact on the oil price than a small oil company making these choices. There's a way you can adapt the model to reflect that pricing effect you can have. It just makes the model incredibly messy. The way I think about these models is, I'm not going to be sitting there actually putting a number on the undeveloped reserves. Just knowing that the undeveloped reserves can behave differently from the developed reserves means that I can differentiate across oil companies, that a LukeOil has to be treated very differently than an ExxonMobil, because even if oil prices go up $10, they'll be affected differently because of the proportion of the value that they get from developed and undeveloped reserves. Which brings me to my second option, the option to expand. Okay. Again, if you think about it, you look at a project, you take the cash flows, you discount them back, you get a net present value. Net present value is negative, don't take the project. Net present value is positive, take the project. Here's the other exception. Sometimes a project can give you the rights to take a second project. I'll give you my classic example for this. Okay? If you look at Apple's current $650 billion market cap, it all started with that first decision they made to develop the iPod, right? You can trace it back, the iPod and the iTunes music store, because the iPod at that time then gave rise to the iPhone to the iPad. So in a sense, that initial product gave them that capacity to do second and third and fourth projects. So an initial investment led to second, third, or fourth investments that added to the value. Same thing can be said if you go into a market. Being successful in the market might allow you to do more stuff in that market. So the option to expand is one of those rare cases. We have two projects that are connected at the hip. The first project has a negative net present value. So let's make it black and white. First project is a bad project. But that first project gives you the rights to a second project, And it's that second project where you get the optionality. Okay? So let's, again, use a simple example to illustrate this. You take a company like Marriott. It decides to open 100 hotels in China. Or it's deciding whether to open 100 hotels in China. It does the cash flows. It comes up with a negative net present value. You're saying, that's easy. Don't open the hotels. But let's say if they open the 100 hotels and they work really well, they attract a lot of customers, more than they thought they would, then it gives them the right to open 500 more hotels all over China. That second investment is the option. The investment you have to make to expand from 100 to 600 will become the strike price. You will do it only if the present value, the cash flows, exceed the cost of expansion. Of course, that might never happen, in which case, what do you give up? You give up that initial negative net present value. That 100 hotels you should never have opened. But for this to work, you have to have some exclusivity. In other words, opening the first 100 hotels has to somehow give you a license, for instance, open up 500 more. And if you can use that license, you have an option on top of an existing project. This is actually one of the more interesting and more dangerous options to think about, because what I'm saying is sometimes when you value a young company and you come up with a discounted cash flow valuation, you're missing the optionality in the company. Okay? This is something I wrestled with when I decided to make my investment in Twitter at 27. My discounted cash flow valuation was actually slightly lower. It was $26.20. I bought Twitter at 27. Seems to be violating my own principle of not buying something for less than it's worth, right? But Twitter does have 340 million users that it can't quite figure out what to do with right now. You see the optionality there? It comes from the fact that they have these users, and users are a tough group to kind of corral if you're a company now, that if they can find a way to exploit these users, that 26 could become 100, 150, 200. It shows up in my simulation. But essentially, I was buying Twitter for the optionality there. So the question is, how do we bring this in real terms, into the numbers? Let me give you an example. This is from my dark side evaluation book. Basically, I did a discounted cash flow valuation of a young technology company, a company that I called SecureMail. It's a company that makes antivirus stuff. And I valued it as a conventional discounted cash flow valuation, and I came up with a value of $115 million from a DCF model. So revenues, operating income, cash flows, conventional DCF. But now let me add something to the mix. Let's assume that while they sell this antivirus software, they're collecting a database of both people who violate that software, people who are writing viruses, and people who are being targeted by those viruses. So the database that they're acquiring is getting bigger and bigger as the business continues, and that sometime over the next 5 years, and I've arbitrarily put a five-year limit, they can spend another $500 million to develop this database program as a second product. Based on what they know now, it wouldn't make sense for them to develop the program because they expect to make only about $40 million a year as cash flows. Already, you can see you don't even have to do net present value, right? If you make $40 million a year for the next 10 years and it costs you $500 million, without even discounting, you have a negative net present value project. And if I discount back at 12%, it's going to become a really negative net present value project. I'm saying, this is useless. Why would they want to do this? They have the exclusive rights to do this sometime over the next 5 years. Let's say that there's a lot of uncertainty in this business. You have no idea what's going to happen. The standard deviation is 50%. The riskless rate is 3%. I have an option, and here's what the option looks like. The value of entering the database market today, it's always about today, is present value $40 million a year for the next 10 years, which is $226 million. The cost of entering the market is $500 million. Right now, this is a project with a negative net present value of $274 million. But here's one of those few cases where ignorance is great. The fact that you don't know much about the market means that you have a huge amount of standard deviation in the value. You have 5 years to play the game and a riskless rate of 3%. I plug those numbers in. I get a value for the call option of $56 million. What the heck is that call option? That is actually the value of the rights to this database program for the next 5 years. Deep out of the money, but because there's so much uncertainty in the business, the value of the option is $56 million. You add that on top of the $115 million, the net present value that you get is $171 million. I am convinced that a lot of really young tech companies, you're not really getting a set of cash flows, you're just buying an option. If you're investing in Snapchat, you're just buying an option. Just be clear about that option and start thinking about what's going to drive the value of the option. Doesn't mean that they don't have to make revenues and operating income. It does mean that everything we've been taught about risk has to be put in the back seat. You want risk to be your ally here because you're buying an option. And that option is making my investment more valuable by adding it on top of my DCF value. So if you're valuing a young technology company, there might be optionality on top, which effectively means that if your stock price gets pretty close to your value, think of it as almost the equivalent of an undervalued company because the option is on top of your DCF value. But the key is always ask that question about exclusivity. Twitter, that came from having the 340 million users. And with a lot of social media companies, it's your user base that is often your exclusivity. It's not forever. It might be for just 2 or 3 years, so don't get carried away and put a 15-year option life. But that's what's going to allow you to pay a premium over the DCF valuation. So final point about this option, because it's easy to get carried away with this, because I often see young growth companies described as options. Okay? The way I describe it, and I mentioned this before, is opportunities are not options. So when I decide to use an option argument, here's the first question I have to ask. Do I have to make the first investment? Does Marriott have to open the 100 hotels now to have the license for the remaining 500? If the answer is no, why am I linking the two together? If the answer is yes, the second question I'm going to ask is, by opening the 100 hotels now, am I getting some exclusivity on the next 500? And the answer is no. Then again, I have to abandon option pricing because then I'm just talking about an opportunity. If the answer is yes to the second, then I'm going to say, where does that advantage come from? Does it come from being the first mover? Is it a technological edge? Or is it some kind of license or a patent that's enforced with the closer I get to exclusivity, the greater the value of the option. So with that secure mail example, if I were pushing from the other direction, the question I would ask is, what's so exclusive about this database you're creating? Is it something that you and only you will have? In which case, I'm willing to give you the 56 million, but the less exclusivity you have there, the less willing I'm going to be to give you the 50 million. So that's the option to expand. Let's pass it through the test. Is there an option? Yes, there is a contingent payoff. That's the easy test to me. Is there exclusivity? It's all over the place. When people talk about strategic benefits and strategic advantages, they're almost always talking about this option to expand. And your pushback should always be, where's the exclusivity? Show me what makes you unique and special. Hey, because if you can show me something that's unique or special, then you pass the exclusivity test. And the weaker your barriers to entry, the less value I will attach to the option. The stronger, the more value. And finally, when I put an option pricing model here, I'm really stretching, right? The underlying asset is not traded. The option is not traded. Much more difficult to use an option pricing model in this scenario to actually value an asset. So when you get a chance, pick up any young tech company, especially something in the news. I mean, it doesn't have to be that young. You can take a Lyft or an Uber and ask, is there an option embedded here? And the reason you're asking the question is not because you actually want to price the option, but because you're asking, you know, how much more than my discounted cash flow value should I be paying for this company because there is an option embedded in this company or this investment? So it's actually a very interesting way to think about young startups or technologies is to think in terms of that added value. That's about it. When we start on Wednesday, we will complete the discussion of option pricing. But we're pretty much done with everything you need for your project. So there's nothing more we're going to be doing that you will need for your project. So if you want to get started today, do so.
Chicago. Okay, yeah.